sleeves. We have a lot to talk about. If you're listening in your car, do not try to roll up your sleeves. Just get set to really focus. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the AJC, is here. What are you writing about for Sunday?
Donald Trump and Delta, Donald Trump and Mary Norwood, and Donald Trump and Casey Cagle.
The trifecta. The Donald Trump Georgia trifecta. We're going to talk a little bit about Donald Trump and Delta during this show. Dr. Andra Gillespie, political science professor at Emory University, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Your T-shirt reads, "The book was better." Is it referred to a specific movie?
No, but in general, I just thought it was funny.
That's a philosophical statement.
I like it. Okay, yeah. I like it. And Eric Tannenblatt, who is a longtime Republican. I always look for the words today. You've been an advisor to a great many Republicans here in Georgia. You've worked with Republicans at the presidential level, George H.W., George W., Mitt Romney. You're just out there doing the work of the Republicans who you care about.
Well, the establishment.
The establishment. I didn't know there. Yeah, I guess there are some left. Good. It's slimmer pickings for you than it used to be. Let's get right to it. Just about an hour ago, the president gave a statement in front of the TV cameras in which he did what everyone expected him to do. He said he would not certify. He's required by law, not just the Iran deal, but any agreement of that sort the United States is in. Every 90 days, the president has to recertify that the conditions of a given deal are being met. He said they are not meeting those conditions. They're not meeting the spirit of the law is part of what he said. Let's just listen to one of the things the president said.
Based on the factual record I have put forward, I am announcing today that we cannot and will not make this certification. We will not continue down a path whose predictable conclusion is more violence, more terror, and the very real threat of Iran's nuclear breakout. That is why I am directing my administration to work closely with Congress and our allies to address the deal's many serious flaws so that the Iranian regime can never threaten the world with nuclear weapons.
Jim, he kind of took middle ground here. We thought for a while that he was just going to plain say we're not in this deal anymore. Instead, he said, I don't like what the Iranians are doing. Congress, you better pass some legislation to set trigger points so that if we need to get out of it, we can.
Right. And you'll notice that he didn't say Iran is not meeting its obligations under the treaty, which pretty much your Washington foreign affairs establishment has said. But I find this interesting. He's kicking the can to Congress, and so this is going to fall to Bob Corker, the Tennessee senator, who just questioned his ability to make presidential judgments.
Yeah, we know that Eric, Bob Corker, and Tom Cotton, his fellow Republican member of the Senate, are already working on legislation to establish triggers that the president says he needs in place so he can, if he wants to, go back to imposing new sanctions.
Yeah, and this should not be a surprise. I mean, he's been previewing this for the last week or so that he was going to take this action. And I think, you know, the fact that you have Corker and Tom Cotton, who was opposed to the deal when it was originally signed, working together, I think shows that, you know, maybe what's supposed to happen with the administration and the Congress is actually working here.
Well, it may not be a surprise, Andra, but the fact of the matter is there are an awful lot of people who think that he is putting us in greater jeopardy by suggesting that he's going to drop out of this arrangement.
Well, I mean, you know, this fits a pattern of things that President Trump has done before. So we could look at the Paris Climate Accord and see our backing out of there. I think there are a couple of questions that, you know, raised by this. Do you want to create another flashpoint, another part of the world as you're dealing with North Korea? And then I'm always brought back to process. And listening to President Trump's justification for decertification, though I was not surprised by this, and though I will admit I'm not the biggest fan of the deal in the first place, every reason that he gave for decertifying dealt with a sort of long history history of not trusting Iran that everybody knew in 2015. I was surprised.
Yeah,
when we signed.
He went back to 1979, yeah. The hostages. He went back to 1983, the bombing by Iranian terrorists of the embassy in Beirut. Then again in 86, he went through the whole history, which was a little unusual.
Right, and so you know, from my perspective, whether or not I like this agreement, the Senate, you know, voted to move ahead with this, and the issue at question is, are they complying with the terms of the agreement now? And if you can provide no evidence to say that Iran isn't complying with the terms of it, then I think that doesn't necessarily seem like the most fair justification for getting out of it.
Yeah, and we are building toward a choice. Do we split with our European partners? Who are parties to this agreement?
They've already criticized it. The Germans, the French, and the Brits.
So we put air between ourselves and our European allies. Or if we just go ahead and deep six the whole agreement, then we've got a nuclear arms race in the Middle East.
To no one's great surprise, President Hassan Rouhani in Iran has already done a televised address responding. The great nation of Iran saw tonight once again that America took a hostile position against an international deal. Eric, just as a last point on this before we move on, what's interesting is that the Iranians have said that even if the United States pulls out of this agreement, it is their intention to maintain the relationship that they've started with, that they have, the agreement they have with the French, the British, and the Germans. So that'll be interesting to watch unfold, because what that would do is just isolate the United States outside of this deal.
Well, and it's also an opportunity for Iran to, you know, show the United States, you know, that they're going to live up to their bargain. And you know, just because the decision was made today doesn't mean that it's going to last in perpetuity.
Right. All right. Well, we're going to leave that because that was the big breaking national story today. But I want to turn for a few minutes, and we'll get to some of it at least before we have to take a break. This week, Andra, the president suggested, we're in the fourth round of the renegotiation process over NAFTA, which the president insisted he had to take on because it's so unfair to the United States. And in the middle of this fourth round, where things are really bogging down, for the first time the president said, well, maybe not for the first time, but President Trump said, I don't know that we can do this deal. We may have to get out. And there are, and we'll talk about them, significant consequences for the United States if they do get out.
Well, and President Trump is clearly playing to his base, who is anti-globalist and who feels that they have been hurt by global trade and free trade in particular. And so this is a boon to them to say that he's standing up for their interests. The question is, has the administration considered all of the externalities that go along with this? This is going, the cost of agricultural prices, commodities could go up as a result of this. There are businesses, including our very own Delta, who can now have tariffs imposed upon them in ways that, you know, it's going to substantially affect their bottom line, and that's going to be passed on to us.
Yeah, I think, Jim, the unions out there are saying, good for him. We want to get more Americans employed. It's a noble goal. But as Andrew points out, the New York Times did a breakdown on this. The tariffs, the duties on most manufacturing goods and all would not be significant if NAFTA were ended. But as Andra alluded to, the Times suggests that farmers could see 25% tariffs on
exactly.
beef and 75% on chicken, which would be a blow to Georgia.
We are the chicken capital, the poultry capital of the United States, maybe of the world. And we wouldn't be able to push our products over into Mexico or point south.
Eric, this is one of those interesting places where the Trump so-called Republican base and the more mainstream Republicans really come into conflict. The Republican business community doesn't want to see NAFTA dissolve.
No, and in fact, you know, earlier this week, our firm actually held a NAFTA 2.0 event in Washington. We had former Prime Minister Harper, Speaker Newt Gingrich. We had Secretary Wilbur Ross, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and discussed a lot of these issues. And look, our own, you know, former governor, now Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, has been very outspoken about the impact on agriculture.
Andrew Gillespie, The president, I let me see if you agree with this. I think that this week, President Trump has really come into his own in terms of it's been his most aggressive week yet in trying to roll back the policies established by his predecessor, President Obama. Certainly, we know the Iran deal is one example. Healthcare, too. Healthcare is even more dramatic. He's done several things this week. And now the most dramatic of all probably is saying they're going to eliminate $7 billion in federal funding to support poorer Americans, low-income families getting health care. And there's been enormous pushback already.
So, you know, one of the things that's been really interesting in looking at what he's done in healthcare is to see what the president can do structurally from his end that he doesn't have to rely on Congress to do. And so it seems to be that he's using executive orders to just dismantle Obamacare. So even if the law still exists, that it for all intents and purposes, doesn't work. So there are a couple of things that I can't say that I'm terribly surprised by. I'm not surprised that in the association proposal where small businesses can come together and cooperatives basically and buy insurance across state lines that we're getting there. I've kind of always thought that the next step was to actually try transportability across state lines as a means to try to lower healthcare costs. So we'll see whether or not that works.
Yeah, that got some good reviews. That wasn't actually, all negative.
Actually not.
No, but that's not true. There are people who think that...
There are people who want to try it.
Right.
But I mean, you can do that in Georgia now. Nobody does it.
Right.
Because you still have to you still have to service your customers, which means you have to have a presence. And, you know, and which state is going to be the one to lower the standards
so those
cheap policies can be sold?
Yeah, that's the problem, is that in not only selling across state lines, but allowing insurance companies to not necessarily follow the mandates of Obamacare and what they have to offer. And besides insurance companies, it's how complicated is it in some cases to try to sell across state lines and deal with the rules? But there are people who are willing to see if this can work. But Eric, the notion of eliminating the subsidy and the president saying, well, that subsidy was a bailout for the insurance companies. They don't deserve it. Look what's happening to their stock prices. They don't support me. That seemed like an odd way to position this.
But let me ask you a question, Bill. Let me flip it on you. I mean, why was it okay for President Obama, by executive order, to authorize the subsidies when Congress didn't?
Yeah.
But now when this president, by executive order, takes away something that a lot of people didn't think was appropriate for the former president to do, now it's such a bad thing.
Well, no, wait. I mean, it is true that Obama did this by executive order, which is why it's been challenged in the courts and why a lower federal court has said it's probably illegal. It's still in litigation.
No. Paul Ryan announced today or yesterday that the government was pulling out of the appeal.
Okay, you got me on that one. Nevertheless, this isn't about whether it's an EO, an executive order, or not. This is about what the substance of the executive order is.
Eric, I think the difference is that you've got a structure built around what Obama did now. And if you withdraw it, it's kind of like a game of Jenga. Things are going to fall down.
And then the Congress, and this may be what ultimately is going to have to happen, is the Congress is going to have to deal with health care reform and how we're going to deal with, which they could not pass, the Republicans, you know, their effort. The House passed it, the Senate couldn't.
So from a structural standpoint, I'm actually really interested in the other things that the Trump administration has done, you know, cutting the enrollment period, not advertising so people don't, you know, always know to sign up for Obamacare. But at least as far as removing the subsidy, I honestly wish we'd asked enough questions last year about what people's actual health care costs were, because when people would talk about these triple digit increases in their health insurance, we don't know how much they were subsidized. But now we're going to see how people react when those subsidies are in fact gone, and we are dealing with 25, 50, 100% increases in terms of health insurance or more. And then I think it becomes a question of, well, who do they blame for this? So President Trump has clearly always invoked the name of President Obama to remind people that this was his idea, but does he get blamed for the fact when people's health insurance subsidies or health insurance rates actually double in fact.
Jim, this could have an enormous impact in Georgia. The Legislative Black Caucus put out a news release just a little while ago saying thousands of Georgians, lower-income Georgians, could be affected by this.
Yeah, last month, Insurance Commissioner Ralph Hudgens went ahead and approved the new premium standards for the four insurance providers that remain in the Georgia healthcare exchange system. Blue Cross and Blue Shield, I think, was going up 57%. All of the other three were above 50%.
Eric, I want to go back to you for a second on this because I don't think anybody would argue that Obamacare needs certainly fixing. And I get it. There are some people who think you need to throw it out and start over. I understand that position. But now we have Patty Murray working across party lines with Lamar Alexander in Tennessee, trying to craft a bipartisan bill, which the White House signaled now they might be interested in, except that Mick Mulvaney this morning on one of the news shows said, we don't want a bipartisan approach. We want to throw out Obamacare completely. They're sending mixed signals on this.
Well, look, all throughout the election, or even prior to the election, we were talking about replacing Obamacare. And the Congress had an opportunity to do it, and they didn't do it. And the president, throughout his campaign, talked about repealing it. So what he's doing is he's doing what he can in his power to repeal it, and it will have to be replaced with something. Yeah. And so I don't think it should be any surprise. And I don't think you just continue bad behavior if in his mind what was put in place is bad behavior. If he can start rolling it back, it's going to make it a lot easier when you have to come up with a new reform plan.
See, but here's the political problem in terms of why people oppose Obamacare. It's not always because they dislike socialized medicine or other things. Because if you ask people about individual components of Obamacare, there are things that are actually very popular. And if those things start to get jeopardized, then Trump might hear from his base. And then there's going to have to be a reckoning with the idea that people opposed Obamacare because it was Obama who came up with it for whatever reason. And there's empirical evidence to suggest that you take Barack Obama's name out of it, people become a little bit more comfortable with that idea. And so it becomes a question of the components of the plan and whether or not people will be willing to go along with that.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I have to, because as long as we're talking about money, let's talk about how much we need your help in sustaining the work we're doing here at Political Rewind. Drew Dawson and Bradley George, take it away. In the Political Rewind studio, Eric Tannenblatt, Jim Galloway, Andre Gillespie. Our frequent tweeter, Ted Barfield, says it's not the subsidy to the buyer that's being cut. Get it right. It's a subsidy to the insurer for playing the market. Well, of course, that's the president's line. But in fact, the subsidy goes to the insurer to reduce the price to the buyer. So thank you for that, though, Ted. And one other update. Tom Faust, our producer, just brought into the studio. We now have our lawsuit, 15 states. Have filed a suit, plus the District of Columbia over president killing the subsidies for low-income families. Eric Tannenblatt, you suspect that those are probably blue states which have filed these suits, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it is.
Okay. That makes sense to me and probably is true, don't you think?
Wouldn't be surprised.
Okay. That doesn't mean that it isn't a legitimate thing, but we understand politics kind of plays a role in all this. Jim Galloway, we've mentioned Delta a couple of times. I think I'm right to say that in the past, I think didn't Delta, and Eric, actually, you might know this. When Trump first announced his tax plan, I think Delta was one of the major companies that said, this sounds like a good plan to us. Am I right about that?
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
And now, though, you have the CEO of Delta, Ed Bastian, who is taking issue, Jim, with President Trump on two big fronts. One, since Delta has a big share in Aeromexico, he is saying that he doesn't like the way Trump is talking about the Mexican people. He thinks we're bigger country than this. That's interesting.
Well, there's a really interesting timeline here, okay? I mean, even before Trump took office, was sworn in after his election, excuse me, Ed Bastian was saying very good things about Trump.
Yeah.
He was there in February at a White House meeting where he thought that Trump was on Delta side on the Middle Eastern issue of subsidized airlines over there and of the air traffic controllers. Excuse me. And then early this month, Delta gets word that the U.S. Commerce Department is preparing to slap a tariff on their purchase of 75 Bombardier jetliners, which, you know, maybe they've purchased for $25 million apiece, and they're now going to cost $100 million apiece.
Yeah, no wonder. Eric Tenenblad,
Bombardier.
Bombardier. Galloway yes. knows how to say it. You do. They're a client. Tell us more about this.
Well, they're a major manufacturer in the transportation sector, not just aircraft. But, you know, they do the train system in San Francisco. I mean, you see their products all throughout
right.
the country.
But in this case, Jim's probably right. We're talking about aircraft that cost $25, $30 million per airplane. This would be an enormous cost to Delta. And yet Delta says, this is crazy. First of all, some of the parts are manufactured for these planes in the United States. Second of all, we can't buy this size aircraft from anybody else. Boeing doesn't make it.
Yeah, but Boeing, this complaint starts with Boeing, right. with the U.S. Commerce Department, and it kind of fits into Trump's America First, buy American situation.
But this also shows you the complexity of you know, what we're dealing with things like NAFTA. I mean, it's not just sound bites, and it sounds great. I mean, we all want to buy America if we live in America, but these are very complicated transactions in the case of Delta. And there are a lot of parts that are manufactured in the United States, so this is not black and white.
And to repeat what something we were talking about off air, this kind of makes Delta the poster child of the NAFTA argument. Of course, it's wanting to cut a pretty big deal with a Canadian firm, and yet it's purchased a 49% stake in Aeromexico,
yeah.
And in order to service more customers south of the border.
Yeah. Well, it also shows that we are now living. We have a global economy. And we, you know, we're working closely together with, you know, industries across the globe.
And what's interesting is that in February, Bastian was at the White House saying Delta was prepared to hire 5,000 extra people over the next couple of years, and Trump was broadcasting that.
Andre, look, we don't want to go too far with this. Bastian and Delta may be back in the Trump column on other issues very soon. But are we beginning to see some of corporate America starting to think twice about whether Donald Trump has their best interest at heart?
Well, I don't. This isn't the first time that
this
has happened.
Well, no, of course it's not the first.
but, I mean, you know, this is an example of people who are directly affected by specific issues that have not been thought about by a campaign kind of raising those issues. And it's incumbent upon a president and his administration to have completely thought through issues. And so sound bites are nice. It's nice to think about things in simplistic terms. But when you're dealing with any big corporation, whether we're talking about the Trump Organization or Delta Airlines or the vast American agricultural industry, like, it's actually a lot more gray than there is black and white, and you've got to be able to deal in the nuance and the complexity.
And I think when the Congress passes tax reform and cuts the corporate rate and puts us on par with countries or business around the globe, I think corporate America will be very happy to have a Republican president, a Republican Congress.
Because we pay the highest tax rate in the world.
Yes,
Jim
but yes, and if
says
if
the White House
if
incorrectly.
If you find a corporation that's actually paying 35%, you need to get them a new accountant.
Well, that's why Bombardier pays Denton's, his law firm, to take care of them, so they don't pay 35% tax rate. All right. I just think it's been interesting, Jim, to follow Delta's path on this, because it does move them a little bit away from the guy.
And the language that Bastian was using got very, very sharp this week. I mean, he says there's no way we're going to get our jets and we're not going to pay the tariff. And the day before that when he was speaking to a group of Hispanic businessmen here in Atlanta, you know, he says, you know, I don't know what they want with that wall, but we're going to fly over the damn thing.
Okay, we've just got a minute before we've got a break again, but as long as I mentioned your law firm, Denton's, Eric, the world's largest law firm, and you preside, of course, over their government relations area here in the United States, we should make a point. Let's very quickly point out that one of your colleagues and partners, Randy Evans, also been a frequent panelist on this show, especially back during the election, on his way, apparently, if he gets confirmed next week, to becoming the ambassador to Luxembourg.
That's right. He was nominated by the president and now is going to go before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And
on Wednesday, right?
Yes, and I believe Senator Johnny Isaacson may be playing a big role in that. He's a member of that committee. And then once that happens, once the committee votes him out, it will then go before the full Senate.
So, Andra and Jim, in the category of why I really feel stupid I didn't become a big lawyer, the AJC today is reporting that Randy Evans may have made as much in his disclosure worth as up to $18 million a year. Not bad.
You said it's the biggest law firm in the...
No, that is not accurate.
Okay, well, it's in the $6 to $18 million
category. I think you're talking about net worth, not his salary.
Okay, you're probably right. Thank you for that, Eric. Once again, speaking of money, if you're Randy Evans and have a lot of it, why don't you contribute to Georgia Public Broadcasting during our radio drive. Drew and Bradley, it's all yours. Jim Galloway, I want to start with you and then go to Eric Tanenbaum because this is about his old boss. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue this week in an interview at the Wall Street Journal Global Food Forum hinted that he thinks perhaps that people who have jobs shouldn't get food stamps. They should go just to people in the greatest need. Now, he just mentioned that. We don't know that it's a policy he's going to pursue, but there are an awful lot of people out there who are troubled by just the way he said.
Georgia right now has a program going where there are people without jobs are losing their food stamps if they're not hunting for jobs. This would carry it to the next level. The problem is that places like Georgia, we don't like unions, and our minimum wage is $5.15. And so you have a whole class of workers, full-time workers, who are eligible for food stamps, and they include many public service servants, including police officers.
You know, Eric, in some ways, this is really kind of a perfect Republican issue. Because what Perdue suggests is that if you take food stamps away from people who are employed, enrollment in the program would drop. And obviously, by that, he's saying that would be a good thing. The government wouldn't have to pay out the kind of funding that they do right now. But obviously, if you're on the other side of that, it feels kind of heartless and cruel.
Yeah, I didn't see Sonny's comments, and it doesn't sound like they were fully reported.
Right.
Look, I think fiscally responsible people want to make sure that, we're watching what we spend. But I think that there's also a belief, at least my belief, and I know a lot of Republicans, that, people should work and we should inspire people to work. That doesn't mean that if you work, you shouldn't get any subsidy, to Jim's point, based on salary. So I don't know if it was that black and white as if you work, you can't get food stamps, or if there was a certain scaling that would be done.
What's interesting about this is that here in Georgia, especially in North Metro Atlanta, there is a pilot program that does exactly the opposite, that actually won't give you food stamps unless you're actually working.
Exactly.
And so we were testing that to see if it works. Some of the preliminary evidence from what I've read suggests that there really isn't any difference. So I think policymakers have to decide kind of what they want. So do you want to force people to work, or do you want to disincentivize people from actually doing the things that would actually get them from welfare to kind of, being
fully
self-sufficient?
Well, that's always been a Republican philosophy.
But actually, what we've seen happen in the past is that you've seen some employers, Walmart at one point was one of them, pay their employees so little with the expectation that they would get public subsidies to help them out, to help them fill out their larders.
Right, but we should all aspire for people to work so that they can afford their own food and not have to
be dependent. But what I'm saying is that in this case, the moochers aren't necessarily the actual workers. They can be the employers rather than the employees.
All right. Well, this is you. By the way, I should clarify. I said that Sonny Perdue was your boss. You were his chief of staff when he was governor of Georgia.
That's right.
So if this happens somehow, it's your fault.
That's right. That's right. I've been blamed for a lot.
Oh, I'm over sure the years. You are. By the way, Todd Rehm tweets to us, aren't food stamps as much about agriculture support as feeding people, hence its place in the Department of Agriculture? Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think we're questioning that that's where it belongs. Mm-hmm. But that, on the other hand, it makes another point. If you start cutting it back, and if it's a support to agriculture, then it's hurting farmers too.
I mean, not just that. I mean, also, if you think about the grocery industry, like, this is also, you know, one of those places where that's a transfer payment that goes directly back into the economy because you have to use it to go buy food. And so that's also going to change how your food sellers are actually going to market and sell products. And that's going to affect their margins in an industry where the margins are historically low. So, I mean, again, nice soundbite, but actually when you get down into the weeds of it, like, lives are affected by this, and I think people need to, you know, think about these things seriously before they make rash statements or rash policy decisions.
All right, before we finish up, Jim, you gave us a little hint of your column on Sunday talking about Donald Trump and Mary Norwood, candidate for mayor of Atlanta, plus Casey Cagle. Mary Norwood has gotten herself in trouble in this race because she's had a hard time explaining whether she supports or doesn't support President Trump.
Yeah, she had a Monday forum where she was asked directly, you know, what do you think of Donald Trump? And her first attempt was not to answer the question at all. And they required her to take a second stab at it. And she says, we have elected a president. And, you know, and not a whole lot more. She, you know, in this race, we've got a forum every night. So she's had time to correct that. And on the Atlanta Press Club debate on Thursday, you know, she did finally get out there that she voted for Hillary Clinton in November.
So what's interesting, of course, about that is that every other candidate in the race identifies as a Democrat. She calls herself an independent, but Democrats have launched a pretty significant campaign saying she's a Republican, don't vote for the Republican.
Which Kasim Reed has coordinated, and Keisha Lance Bottoms have taken advantage of to great
which
extent.
Is unfortunate because the city of Atlanta elections are supposed to be nonpartisan elections.
On our next show, Jim Galloway, on Monday, we have to talk about an interesting ruling that's come down in the city of Atlanta elections office. If the Emory CDC neighborhood of DeKalb County becomes part of Atlanta before the election, the city election boss now says those people will be able to vote. Now, we can't get into it all now, but that could have an enormous impact on this race. But you're going to have to wait till Monday to hear about that because we're completely out of time for our show today. Jim Galloway, Andrew Gillespie, Eric Tenenblatt, thank you for being here. And thank you all at home, in your cars, in your offices for listening. And if you're supporting us, thank you for that as well. Have a good weekend.